Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, the City of Boulder has launched an Emergency Response Connectors programme to share information on COVID-19 and to educate the community on resources that are available. We'll get a report on what that looks like. Then, if you are using the coronavirus crisis to evaluate your own health habits, a long-time naturopath would like to help you think outside of the box in ways you view long-term wellness. We'll hear more later in the Morning Magazine. After that, what is it like to be recovering from addiction during the current pandemic? In-person support meetings are cancelled, and for many, those meetings are an integral part of the recovery process. We'll hear how some people in Colorado are navigating recovery during the COVID-19 pandemic. After headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, we'll hear from the Boulder County Sheriff and the head of Boulder County Parks and Open Space. They were two of the co-signers of a letter to the community late last week about outdoor activities during COVID-19. We'll hear about their concerns, and we'll also be joined by the head of Open Space from Jefferson County. At 9 o'clock, we'll have media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news on public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
The air quality along the Front Range has seen significant declines in levels of major pollutants, as thousands of cars are off the road due to the statewide stay-at-home order. But three pollutants closely linked to the oil and gas operations have continued to spike. The Times Call reports that the increase clearly shows that the industry's effect on the Front Range's air quality. On March 26th, an air quality specialist hired by Longmont to analyze oil and gas emissions saw the highest levels of methane he's ever seen. The expert Detlev Helmig said that the spike lasted only about 10 minutes, but it was like someone had opened up a spray can. He said that the level of methane increased to 35 parts per million, while the highest level they've ever seen at Boulder Reservoir was about a tenth of that. Helmig said that it is difficult to know what caused the monstrous spike in methane, and added that the wind was blowing from the north. The closest active fracking site to the monitoring station at Union Reservoir is slightly less than 1 mile to the north, and Helmig said that the gas was likely to have leaked and come from a well site from that direction. There were also large spikes of benzene and ethane on another day at the end of March, suggesting the spike came from an oil and gas operation. While industry leaders have said that they are committed to limit their contributions to Front Range air pollution, Helmig's data would seem to suggest the opposite, at least for some fracking sites. On Friday, the Denver Public Health Department released data that shows that blacks in the city have been impacted by COVID-19 at higher rates than whites or Latinx residents. It is important to note that the small size of sampling numbers, but Denver's black population has been represented at higher numbers of total infections, hospitalizations, and deaths from the coronavirus. 13% of those with confirmed infections in Denver have been black, while the city's black population is only 8%. Infection rates of whites and the Hispanic or Latinx population in Denver are less than their proportionate shares of residents. Rates of hospitalization and deaths show the same disproportionate effect on blacks. State Representative Leslie Herrod, a Democrat of Northeast Denver, has been calling on the state to release more data detailing the race of people testing positive for COVID-19, and she wants the state to provide a response focusing on people of color. The Denver Post reports that the initial data from Denver reflects much of what has been seen in other cities like Detroit and Milwaukee. New data released yesterday from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment show that through Saturday, the state has more than 7,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. The true number of infections is likely 4 to 10 times higher than that number. Nearly 300 people have died in the state from the virus. The union representing 3,000 employees of JBS Meatpacking Plant in Greeley is urging Governor Jared Polis to close the facility after the second death of a worker related to the coronavirus. Union leaders believe the plant should be closed for 1 week and deep cleaning should be conducted during that time. The Denver Post reports that a spokesperson for JBS said the facility was closed for the three-day weekend plus tomorrow to ensure employees can be tested, but this is not as long as the union is demanding. Union spokesperson Kim Cordova said she knows of 42 union members as well as 8 non-union employees at JBS who have tested positive. However, they believe that number may be significantly more. JBS USA operates 65 facilities in the U.S. and has shut down one in Pennsylvania for 2 weeks. Representatives of Boulder County and educational leaders will host a virtual town hall this evening to discuss the impact of the coronavirus on higher education. Led by State Representatives Jonathan Singer, Democrat of Longmont, and Sonia Jaquez Lewis, Democrat of Lafayette, the town hall will also include CU Boulder's Chancellor Phil DiStefano and a regent of the CU system, among others. The participants will share resources, updates, and answer questions from the community. The Daily Camera reports the town hall will take place from 6 to 7:30 this evening and will be conducted through a Zoom link. In other news, the U.S. 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled Friday that a federal lawsuit challenging Boulder's gun ordinance should wait until the state Supreme Court makes a decision on whether the measure violates Colorado law. In 2018, the Boulder City Council passed a ban on the sale of and possession of assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. The measure also raised the minimum age for gun possession to 21. Colorado Politics reports that several people and organizations then sued, alleging violations of the state and federal constitutions. A federal trial court said it would defer its ruling until the Colorado Supreme Court reached a decision on whether Boulder's ordinance violates state law. The federal appeals court has now agreed with that lower court and will wait for a decision in the state courts. Today it will be snowy with a new accumulation of about 1 to 3 inches and a high near 26. Snow continuing tonight with a low about 13. Tomorrow looks to be warmer with a high of 42, but a chance of snow in the afternoon. Right now it's a chilly 18 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 12 minutes past 8 o'clock. The City of Boulder has launched a team of emergency response connectors to share COVID-19 information, to educate the community about resources and to document concerns and issues raised by community members, all while practicing social distancing. KGNU's Rosanna Longo has more.
The program is meant to provide equitable information distribution across the diverse cultures within Boulder through community members who are trusted voices within their neighborhoods. One of those connectors is a young DACA recipient, Jesus Salazar.
My name is Jesus Salazar. I'm a resident of Boulder representing my community, Orchard Grove Mobile Home Community. And I'm also a community connector with the City of Boulder and a small business owner.
The emergency response connectors will work to develop a creative way to keep their neighbors informed and to provide opportunities for two-way communication between residents and governments. They will also help neighbors empower each other in various ways during this difficult and unique time, which may include matching high-risk neighbors with those who want to help, coordinating virtual gatherings for safe social connection, and developing a virtual network through email and social media platforms. The city project team is conducting this pilot as a new model for supporting disaster response in the City of Boulder and in Boulder County.
City of Boulder has actually been pretty proactive in establishing a team of community connectors as an emergency response team. There's about 7 to 15 of us at the moment, and from different communities, from the Spanish community, English community, and other communities as well. And basically what we're doing is finding ways and methods to inform our community over what's going on and making sure that they're doing well, if they need anything, that they're being taken care of. So in a sense, they've been really proactive as of now.
Salazar shares his personal experience and concerns.
Really, from my opinion and my personal point of view, I've noticed that, you know, there's this talk about a relief fund and, you know, the check coming. But as we all know, not many of us have a social security or have a way to qualify for that help. And so a lot of us are scared of, you know, what's going to happen. I mean, most of us, we were able to pay the first month, but who knows how long this is going to go for. And how we're going to make ends meet for, you know, a couple more months.
To many undocumented immigrants working in fields worst hit by the crisis, such as the restaurants and hospitality industries, they are ineligible for unemployment insurance. That is something that concerns Jesus Salazar, and he says that a lot of people are worried about not having enough money to pay the rent or to buy food.
So I think one of the most urgent things is job security, as we've mentioned. You know, some of us are lucky to have some kind of paycheck still coming, but most of us don't. So we're really, you know, taking out of our savings and, you know, trying to make ends meet. So I think the most urgent is finding a way to get resources like EFA and other programs out there that help the community, and, you know, at least with food, or, you know, programs that will be able to cover rent at least for a couple months.
Home security is the biggest threat that mobile home communities are experiencing at this moment.
What I'm seeing in our mobile home communities as the biggest threat to our well-being, from my experience again, is paying rent. You know, that's a big thing. Some of our landlords aren't being as flexible, and they still demand that we pay rent in full. So we're pushing to see if there's some kind of some middle ground that we can reach, because that is our biggest concern, is the rent fees. Some people have water fees. That's the main thing is the home security. You know, it's if we don't have the ability to go out and work, there's, you know, more jobs are being lost and more people are filing for unemployment. So that's really the biggest.
Most of the people don't have a social security number, and they are owners of small businesses, but they cannot qualify for Small Business Relief Fund.
Most of us, or a lot of us, at least from the people that I know in our community, is we don't have a social security. We don't have ways to get, you know, the relief check that there's been a whole conversation about. Some of us don't apply for or qualify for the small business loan or the PPP. So that's really difficult. And also, as a DACA, you know, recipient myself, you know, even then, some of these funds are restricted to just, you know, other people.
Another concern Jesus Salazar shares is the concern that the majority of the people that live in his neighborhood, they don't have a health insurance. And they are scared that they will not have the money to pay for the treatment.
Some of us, or most of us, don't have health insurance, or, you know, insurance that will cover medical bills. And some places won't take you in if you don't have, you know, that insurance. Or some of us are scared that we won't have enough to pay for these, you know, treatments.
But there is a situation that Jesus Salazar would like to point out that has him really frustrated.
You know, this frustration that we're, you know, as you mentioned, we're not being told of, you know, if that resident has COVID-19, or they don't mention anything like that. I mean, personally, we've had an experience where we went to clean a house and the homeowner asked us if we were feeling well, if we were sick or anything like that. And of course, we were, you know, we're feeling healthy. We haven't had any interaction with someone like that that had COVID-19, thankfully. And we did the housekeeping, we cleaned and everything. And then 3 days after, they text us letting us know that they tested positive for COVID-19. And we were really upset. I mean, we couldn't leave the house for at least 14 days. And, you know, given the situation, we couldn't go out to work. We couldn't have that income. So it was really upsetting to see that, especially having a, you know, a well-established relationship with that client. And it just goes to show that sometimes they see us as kind of like disposable, as, you know, they'll come do the work, they'll get paid, they just want the money. But really, you know, we should be considered just as equally as other people, and we should be let us know of the situation. Again, my name is Jesus Salazar with Orchard Grove Community, and also as a community connector of the city of Boulder. And really, you know, a shout out to the city of Boulder for stepping up and doing this emergency response team. We also have the city text mobile app program provided by the city as a way to get your news through there. And also, if you have any questions, you can text it at the same number, and the city staff will actually reply to your answer. And it's free, doesn't ask for your name, address, legal status. It's just a number to text you.
11 stipend-based emergency response connectors live or work within hard-to-reach or underrepresented communities, providing information in a more accessible and trusted ways. The city project team is conducting this pilot as a new model for supporting disaster response in the city of Boulder and Boulder County.
And thanks to KGNU's Rosanna Longo for that report. It is 8:21. You're listening to KGNU. Jesus Salazar, who was featured in that report, was also featured in one of our podcasts as part of our Trends series. That's a collaboration between KGNU and the Community Foundation of Boulder County. And he was featured as a community connector, but organising around mobile home residence issues, particularly in Orchard Grove. Now, we encourage you to check out all of our podcast offerings. We have so many available, wonderful archives for you to listen to, maybe if you are looking for some stories during this time of social isolation. There is our Trends podcast, our Radio Book Club podcast, of course, our weekly science show as well. Just search for KGNU wherever you get your podcasts. Well, around the world, tens of thousands of people have come forward who want to help others survive the coronavirus pandemic. That includes Boulder's Charlie Cropley, a naturopathic physician and teacher who's been helping people improve their health since 1979. KGNU's Ros Brown says that Cropley is passionate about encouraging people to use the current health crisis as an opportunity to make positive changes.
We don't need to quiver in isolation here. There's abundance that we can do, and when we do it, we stop being so scared.
Charlie Cropley has been a Front Range practicing naturopath for more than four decades. Naturopathic medicine is a system that uses natural remedies to help the body heal itself. Cropley says a novel coronavirus called COVID-19 is no exception. He notes the coronavirus pandemic is now being called a war, but that implies we don't have control over how we're impacted.
Our present relationship, our cultural, conventional relationship with illness is that illness is an enemy, something to be feared, something to be fought against and destroyed. And it focuses outside ourselves on an enemy.
Cropley says there are four pillars of naturopathic medicine, the first being what we eat.
We transform our health by transforming the ways that we eat. How do we eat as a country? Horribly. Our food has been stolen from us and processed and sold back to us in ways that do nothing but make us sick. And then when we become sick, we are given pharmaceuticals because we're poisoning ourselves by the foods that we eat.
Cropley adds that movement or exercise is also inherent wisdom that allows the body to heal itself.
Movement is the second area. We are talking about a virus that attacks our lungs and creates an interstitial pneumonia. The lungs are healed by and can be strengthened through breathing exercises and also by the power of fresh air. The third area is the use of our minds, teaching people the power that we have to heal ourselves and focusing on ourselves and our own behaviors and using our minds to care for the suffering in our minds, the anxiety, the depression, the grief, the negative emotions that we feel. People can learn how to change their relationship to those, just like the relationship to illness in our physical body.
Social distancing has proven extremely effective in our current health crisis, but people across the globe have found ways to connect with loved ones on Skype, Zoom, email, or the old-fashioned telephone. He prefers to call the current situation distant socializing, which he says is more critical than most of us realize.
And the fourth area that is huge is that of community and of relationship and bringing ourselves together to be together and to talk with one another and be in communication about making these changes, what changes we're making in our own personal lives, in our areas of eating, of moving, of thinking and relating, and helping one another to do those, because the work of healing ourselves comes down to the work of finding the ways that we are harming ourselves in each of these areas.
Crabley says it's important to know what we can know about the new virus, but we should also turn our attention to ourselves.
That's where the power is. We are making ourselves susceptible to things that we never would have been susceptible to before.
For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
You can find more information about Charlie Cropley's newest 14-day immunity course at his website, charliecropley.com. That's charliecropley.com. Well, what does recovery from addiction look like during the current COVID-19 pandemic? For many people, community support is crucial. But how to navigate that during this time of social isolation? Matt Hoish from our partner station, KOTO in Telluride, has more.
Dave-O is looking forward to an upcoming milestone.
If I'm lucky enough to make it, I'll have 15 years sober next month.
Dave-O lives in the Telluride area. We're not using his last name because he wants to remain anonymous. When we spoke, next month meant April. But Dave-O is also sheltering in place because of the coronavirus, so he's unsure what he'll do.
You know, normally we have celebrations at meetings and we get these coins that show like 15 years or whatever. People bring a cake or whatever. We have cake after the meeting and we go out to dinner. This year, since it's next month, who knows if that'll even happen or not.
That we he's talking about is members of his recovery community. Each individual is different, but many people, when recovering from alcoholism or drug use or any kind of addiction, rely on the support of others to recover and to avoid relapsing. But when people socially isolate to avoid the coronavirus, that can be hard.
There are so many circumstances that could be triggering, especially if there's trauma in the background, like a lack of foundation, a lack of knowing, a lack of security. It's easy, you know, to lose the sense of presence.
That's Linton Moore. She's lived in the area for 3 decades and used to be the substance abuse provider for San Miguel County. Now she has a private practice. She says those social connections are a powerful way to prevent relapse, which, according to her, doesn't just happen at the flip of a switch. She says relapse can occur after weeks or even months of gradual changes in behavior and thought.
And you have to actually work. It's almost like battling yourself again. And that's why reaching out to people is really important, so that you're not just stuck in the mind that just keeps going round and round and round.
One way Dave-O is helping himself and others do that work while isolating is through virtual meetings on platforms like Zoom.
It was no different except that we were seeing each other on a computer instead of in person.
Well, there is at least one difference. Unlike meeting in person, digitally, people can join from anywhere. People like Aaron. Again, we're only using his first name. Aaron lived in Telluride for 20 years. It's where he got sober. Now he lives in Brooklyn, where he says his recovery community is less connected than it was in Telluride. When he got an invite from his old roommate to join the Telluride Zoom meetings, he didn't expect how meaningful it would be.
I didn't realize the level of anxiety and stress that I had been dealing with, because it was built up over the course of a few weeks. And the connections, the human connections and the recovery connections had been dwindling and dwindling. And then I connected with the group in Telluride via Zoom, and it gave me a pretty deep sense of comfort knowing that they were all there in the world doing the same thing that I was. It was really comforting beyond anything that I thought it would be.
Digital recovery communities aren't anything new. They were around before the coronavirus pandemic. Chris Paish is the co-founder and chief operating officer of Sober Grid, an app that helps people connect with others nearby and throughout the world in recovery. Through surveys, his team found that while many users are looking for help to get sober, just as many are sober people looking to help.
About half of those who responded let us know that they were in early recovery or still struggling, and they were really using it as a lifeline, as a means to receive support. But interestingly, the other half of those who responded, many of them indicated they were in longer-term recovery, sometimes 5, 10, 15 years or more, and their primary reason for using the app was to support others as a means of how they maintain their own program of recovery.
Paish notes that during widespread social distancing, users are sharing and posting on the app, and his team has started hosting their own Zoom meetings for users. Mindsets also help. Aaron says one idea from his recovery that is also motivating him during this pandemic is taking things one day at a time.
this thing isn't going to last forever, but it's going to last for right now.
Davo shares a similar sentiment as he thinks about his upcoming milestone.
I'll be happy that I have 15 years of sobriety, but what's important is 15 years in one day.
Video meetings aren't for everyone, and they aren't some sort of universal solution. Again, everyone's recovery is different. Linton Moore, for instance, worries that, at least in Telluride, there aren't enough ways for younger people to connect and work toward recovery. But especially in times of necessary isolation, technology can help some people, like Davo and Aaron and many more, connect and keep up their recoveries, one day at a time.
And that report from Matt Hoisch at our partner station, KOTO in Telluride.